Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of So Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Happy Aramaic Friday, and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Shalpa Shea, and I'm here today with Dale Hoffman and Dr. Tim Hayes as co-hosts. We warmly welcome you to the show and thank you for choosing to be with us. Today is May 2nd, 2014. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169. Press 1 and that puts you into queue to talk with Dale and Tim. We encourage you to call in with your comments or questions, allowing you to actively strengthen and deepen your practice. So now let's join our host in the process of learning and experiencing forgiveness.
Thank you, Michelle. Happy Friday, everyone. Happy Aramaic Friday. And welcome to the Mind Shifters Radio, where our whole purpose is to understand and then apply in our lives as accurately as possible the teachings of a man named Yeshua and the practical tools that come from his teachings that can result in us having a more loving, a more productive, and a more joyful life. And one of the ways we do that is that we actively practice the tool of forgiveness, which is not about pardoning someone or letting anybody else off the hook. It's about actively using tools to go into my mind and body's energy system and remove anything that's less than love. And there's a tool for that that's been made available through the ancient Kabbalist manuscript and Dr. Michael Rice's work and Jeannie's work, and it's on the website at www.whyagain.org. And that website opens up and gives you a red and white bullseye in the center of the page. If you click on that, it takes you to a page that offers free downloads of Dr. Michael Rice's Chapter 24 of his book, Explaining the Worksheet Process, the most recent version of the 7-step worksheet process itself, an entire panoply of downloads of audio shows just like this, internet shows just like this, where Dr. Rice or Jeannie have stepped people through the worksheet process. So on that one page, available absolutely for free, is all the material you'd ever need to get introduced to and begin to practice and eventually become a master at the ancient Aramaic technology of forgiveness. And today we're honored to have Dale Ellen Hoffman with us, who has been working with studying the ancient Aramaic and trying to help us understand in common English terms what was being said thousands of years ago. Dale, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing, Tim?
Fabulous, fabulous. Thank you so much for being here. How are you
today? I'm doing beautiful. I'm not so far from you. Well, I'm a few hours away. I'm in Mishawaka, Indiana at the moment, actually. My whole family have come up with me. I'm at a place called Spiritual Waters, our Sacred Waters Spiritual Center in Mishawaka. I'm literally just a few blocks from Notre Dame and Holy Cross. So there's an interesting energy here. It's neat to see a lot of kids, although I didn't grow up Catholic, it's neat to see a lot of kids wandering all over the campus, and it's kind of taken me back to being at that age and not knowing what was coming in my life. Just knowing that it was going to be something exciting, I never could have anticipated that it could have turned into what it is, just because I've been open and just let it birth through me. It's been a pretty amazing experience up to this point.
Well, that is, it's a delightful energy. It's a delightful place. I have a family tradition that goes back there several generations. So, well, are you doing a series of presentations there?
Yeah, actually, that probably would have made sense if me to mention that. Last night I did just a small gathering here with some people, just a little bit of toning, a little bit of reframing the Jesus teachings from the ancient Aramaic perspective. And I did doing some private sessions in tomorrow. Today's actually my birthday, so it's like I brought my family with me, which was neat because they're able to be with me. Usually I'm somewhere else on my birthday. Well, I guess I am, except my family's with me. Tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m., I'm headlining the Expanding Horizons Expo, a little spirit expo here in South Bend, and I'm going to be speaking at the State Theater downtown, the classic State Theater downtown tomorrow from 7 to 9 p.m. And it's been an interesting, well, it's been less than 24 hours actually that we've been here, because some people are like, you know, this is a very Catholic town, you may want to sort of tone the message down a little. And I thought about that, and I mean, I'm not a toner downer at all, you know that. And I thought about it, and I sort of felt it through, and I was like, you know, I'm not here to tone something down. It's an interesting thing that I think some people, all of us have it in us to some degree, that we feel that just because people's buttons are pushed that somehow we shouldn't live our life to the fullest. And we got to remember that, you know, each of us is in the process of our own healing. And I just started thinking about it. I couldn't imagine Jesus toning it down, or imagine if Martin Luther King, you know, just played it safe, or whoever it may be, Gandhi just kind of got quiet and sat in the corner. It doesn't work like that. What needs to be heard is going to be heard. There's certain things that I don't necessarily pull out of the box on you know, in a first gathering with a place that I've never been to before. I'm pretty excited for tomorrow night, because what I'm going to be doing is, well, begin with toning, but I'm going to sort of, I don't know if methodically is the word, but I'm going to be using a PowerPoint, which I don't usually do, and people are going to actually be able to see some of the sacred text. I'll be using huge projections of the Kaboris manuscript. I'm actually going to show them places where certain mistakes or misunderstandings were made, and show them some actual, like, copies of the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Philip. I'm pretty excited, though. And then what I'm going to do in the first half is just share about how when we're sort of in the forest and we're looking at all the trees in the forest, we tend to miss the forest itself. And in a lot of cases, we draw things, we connect things together that aren't necessarily connected. We add things in that aren't really there. And we also miss things that aren't sort of on our within our brain cells or on our radar, so to speak. And the basic essence of the first half of my talk is that, to the best of our ability, we should be able to take a few steps back and be conscious of what is there and what's not there, and just see it like it is, and seek to unveil the meaning within what we do know and what we don't know, and being okay with that. And in the second half, I'm actually going to go into some of the teachings and show how certain things were misunderstood or just not looked at closely enough. Things like Mary and the seven demons, the casting out of seven demons, the I am phrases from the Gospel of John, things like the first beatitude, poor in spirit, and how it's not really about Aramaic and Greek in a lot of cases. I mean, that's a lot of Greek is like this strange pincushion, I think. But when you actually, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, the Greek is flawed, the Greek is this. But it's not only that at all, actually. When you actually do enough study, you realize a lot of the problems didn't even happen in the Greek. A lot of the problems actually happened going into Latin. And the fact is that the Aramaic culture of the first century was just as violent as the Greek culture of the first century. A lot of people don't realize these kinds of things. When you start looking into stuff like that, it kind of balances the field a little bit, and you realize that if I start pointing at something as somehow being wrong or not getting it and having a rub with that, that rub has nothing to do with what I'm pointing at. It has everything to do with me not being willing to bring that up to the surface. And it's just an interesting process. I'm excited about tomorrow night. We have no idea how many people are going to be there, but I do know that the word is spreading. So it should be a great event.
I'm sure it will be, and happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah, I forgot I mentioned that. But
yeah, congratulations.
Congratulations for making it this far.
Well, and for being able to have your family with you this time around. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's actually, it's rare. This is only the second time in 12 months that my family has actually been. I think the last time was Panama City Beach back in October. It's sort of rare just because, well, I mean, if you just look at it in the financial aspect, not only does it multiply everything by four or five, but the intensity of traveling is much different. We left yesterday morning at 6 a.m. from Asheville and got here about 4:30, and it's much different traveling with your entire family than it is either yourself or just yourself and one, you know, one child. But it's really been beautiful. The area here is beautiful. There's geese outside. There's goslings outside. Like I said, we're just a couple of blocks from Notre Dame, which for me is a really, I'm looking forward to maybe a little bit today and more tomorrow, getting to the university and looking around, going to the grottos. And I'm very excited because 10 years ago, someone asked me last night, did I ever get to a point where I felt cynical or really sort of angry and kind of pissed off, so to speak, at the manipulations, the misunderstandings, the mistranslations? And I said, yeah, I did, and I had to get over it. Because I realized if I'm standing here pointing at, like as an example, Catholicism and trying to blast Catholicism, it's got nothing to do with Catholicism. It has to do with some button that's inside of me that's somehow being rubbed or triggered by Catholicism. And I realized that most of the people in a lot of these different philosophies, whatever the structures of comfort, whatever the frames are well-intentioned people, that they're looking for the best and they're doing the best they can with what they know. So what's most important is that I'm able to extend love and presence to everyone and yet also not dumb the message down and be very clear with what we do know, what we don't know, and give people the chance to continue to walk on with whatever they believe, regardless whatever it is that I'm putting out there, because it's not about them in my life, it's about me. And for them, it's about them, and not in a narcissistic sense so much as each of us have our own work to do. And yeah, I've done a lot of sort of ruminating since I've been here. Just less than 24 hours, the energy here is palpable, being in Notre Dame. Maybe it's the Fighting Irish and the football thing, I don't know. Maybe it's lacrosse. There's a big lacrosse event going on right now. But
I look forward to hearing your input after you've been down to the grotto. By the lake and in the cathedral, because, as you said, the energy is palpable. And
everybody has basically told me since I got here, go to the grotto. And, of course, it was something that I'd heard before I came here, so I'm pretty sure that'll happen today. I'm excited. I'm honored. I'm honored to be here. I'm honored to be anywhere. I'm just honored that people are open. We had a great group last night. Courageous group, some young ones in there. I love having the young ones, and I love having the ones that are 70s and 80s and 90s, you know, some that are even over 100 at times, who are just open, and they just want to be open. It's just a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful experience.
Yeah. Well, you were traveling yesterday, so you probably didn't hear about the show, but Michael and Jeannie were in the office of Dr. Donald Jolly Gabriel. And if I understand this correctly, he is at the university where they're now holding the Caboris manuscript. And
wow.
It was wonderful having him talk about he did a little presentation about a letter he got from his mother in the 50s when he was at college or something. And his mother was telling him about how her gay friends were coming over for a party that evening. And he talked about how in just 50 years, in the same language, the meaning of a word can change so dramatically. And that's why it's so important to have people like you, Dale, going back and looking at ancient manuscripts, not just for the letter of the word and what it means and what it meant, but in the context. And they also did some talking about idioms, and he had a transfer student or an exchange student living with him for whom English was a second language. And he talked about several of the miscommunications that occurred because of the idioms in the English language that were offensive to this young man. Mm-hmm. So it was a wonderful show yesterday, and really highlighting the need for the work you're doing.
I was just going to say that's really the essence of my focus tomorrow night is, like, as an example, okay, let's look at certain words. And just because you can define a word doesn't mean that you realize what that word means. It doesn't mean that you actually comprehend its meaning. And what one of the central aspects of, you know, what I seek or what I am doing in my work is getting the meanings of the words and the terms down to their pure essential nature. And that doesn't mean literality. Literality is a touchy subject because people think, like, I can see a literal translation, but literal doesn't necessarily mean that it actually embodies the nuances of what it means. Literal translations usually are, as an example, a good example would be the word abid. Abid is a word that if I were to go to Saudi Arabia and go to someone with dark skin and say abid, I would probably get my teeth punched out because it basically means now you're a groveling dog. It means that you are subservient to me, especially if you have dark skin. It's like the N-word here in America. So a literal translation of the word in Arabic could be that you are my slave, essentially. But what that word meant in Aramaic, however, was not submitting to me, but rather submitting to the truth of what is right now in this moment, submitting to the true direct experience of the moment. And what happens is, like as an example, some people will hear what I do and will go, oh, well, I'm not interested because there's, you know, the literal translations are a dead-end street. And I'm like, well, this isn't about literalism. This is actually about the deepest nuances of meaning. And just because you know what a word means in terms of dictionary-wise or definition does not necessarily mean that you know what those words actually mean. Burn it down. Like, you know, the good example was the word glory that I've used on some of the past shows. And if you break that word glory down, tishbukta in Aramaic is one of the words for glory, it means to be fully present in this moment. It's a feminine ta, a feminine state of being, where you have no goal from the moment, but you're just open to the experience of the moment. When you're fully open in the presence of this moment, life seems to give off a sheen or a shine or like facets, like a glimmering, shining essence, and that's what the word glory means in Aramaic. So just because you know that teshbukta means glory doesn't mean that you know what glory means, is basically what I'm getting at. And if there's any sort of real meaning to what I've been doing lately, it's realizing that if there's still something unexplained when I translate a word, then my job isn't complete. If people are still going, all right, but what does that mean? And I haven't followed it all the way to the end. From the first century perspective, at least from what we know, if I haven't followed it all the way to the end, then my job's incomplete.
Well, it's very moving at different times just to sit and listen. And at different times when you're talking, I just feel the shivers. And I got one of those when you were here in Woodstock, and you were talking about how back in the time of Yeshua, they didn't even have the word Lord. And could you talk a little bit about Maria and Lord?
Oh, absolutely. You know, people, first of all, I think, you know, when we hear Maria, we think of Italian, we think of Latin, not knowing that that word was actually taken from Aramaic into Latin. As an example, one of the things that I'll say is, you know, Jesus, I can say absolutely unequivocally that Jesus was never called Lord, nor did he ever call anyone or God or whatever his God being was Lord. And the reason I know that is because the word Lord did not exist in the first century. Lord is a medieval English feudal term, and Lord, of course, if we studied feudalism in school, we realized that feudalism was the land process. The land owner would be called the lord of the land, and of course you have the serfs and the peons below him that would be working, and the sharecroppers, etc. And what Lord means in the English sense is essentially a power person. If we look into codependence to interdependence from Michael's work, and we look into the power person, that's what Lord means. So when we grow up calling Jesus a Lord, there's kind of a power that he has that we don't, even though everything he says is that you can do all that I've done, even greater things, and it's not me, it's the one within me. It's the presence that bursts through me that's doing this, not me myself. So if we put Jesus as power position, then we miss the meaning of what that means. Now, that word Maria, or Maria in Aramaic, what that meant was someone who shines a feminine light. Feminine light is different than masculine light, like the sunlight that's shining through my window right now would be called a masculine light. It's obvious, it's manifest, it's something that I can easily see with my naked eye. However, feminine light is the light that is not necessarily seen so much as sensed. Feminine light is the light of a child. Feminine light is the light of a baby in that first, you know, that Michael talks about, that first 30 minutes of life, that living, breathing being, and there's that beautiful light. And we, you know, we meet people at different times who have this light. And what those people were called back then was Maria, the ones who shine feminine light. And it's interesting because there's also the word Mari. Now, Mari, minus the ah sound at the end, is something that would be closer to Lord, but not necessarily in the English feudal sense. Mari would be something like a common everyday guy walks up to me, and it was like a term of endearment, or really a term of respect, Mari, Mari. They would call him Mari, and Mari was basically, it's translated today as Lord, but it doesn't, we got to drop the word Lord, because the word Lord is English, and it's not that, you know, we're using English words, but Lord itself is so charged with so many facets of meaning that have nothing to do with the first century. Really, what it was saying is, what that's really saying in Aramaic, Mari, it wasn't even Lord. It's like, my dear one, my respected one, you know, the one before me, you know, I honor your presence, essentially. It had nothing to do with that power person layer that's in that English feudal term, Lord. So there's certain words that we really have to let go of, and that's definitely one of those words, because if we're not able to take a step back and see the forest for the trees, then we're not going to see the forest. If we're so obsessive just with our own frame of understanding, then there's no true comprehension or understanding of what things actually meant or what they actually mean below the surface, just like people's common everyday words don't necessarily reflect what they're really feeling deeper down below the surface.
Wonderful. Well, we had somebody ask a question when you were here in Woodstock, and they asked something about, is there anything in Yeshua's teachings about how doing versus non-doing?
Mm-hmm.
And you gave an answer that said it's a thread that's woven all the way through his teachings as an aspect of that feminine aspect of things or energy of things. And at the time, I thought of this, some kind of a quote about, you know, take no heed for the morrow. What about the flowers in the field and the birds and the wing? Doesn't the Lord take care of them? And that was a quote I couldn't come up with. That was one that has been resonating in my mind ever since. Can you talk about that idea that from the Western mind, we're thought we got to go do, and Yeshua's teachings were more about an internal process.
Well, absolutely, doing or action would be considered an action or doing something would be considered masculine. Well, of course, that's not a bad thing. The masculine doing, you know, the action is part of life. But what happens is when we, the aspect of, as an example, the non-doing, the wu-wei of the I Ching, Yeshua's teachings were more about the feminine. They were more about the experience. It wasn't about the action that you were doing. It wasn't about the words that you were saying. It wasn't about the person that you appear to be. It wasn't about the physical things that you do. It's rather, in the Jesus teachings, about the state of your presence or the lack of presence in those actions. It's never about the thing itself. It's always about your being, your consciousness in that process. And that's where the non-doing comes to. Or as an example, if I go, you know, a good way to put this across is if I go and do a favor for a neighbor and I'm grunting the whole way, then I'm actually lacing those actions in with that hostility and the anger and the different things that are lacing into it. And he was talking about that. He was talking about the state of our being in his teachings. He wasn't talking about the physical things to do. And there were occasionally times that he would say, okay, look, if, like as an example, if you want to put your sacrifice on a physical altar, whether it's a lamb or something on the petore or the matbaka, there's a couple words for physical altars, that's fine. But understand that the act of your physical altar can never take the place of the elata. Elata is a word, ta, which of course genders it feminine, which means that it's experiential, it's a state of being, it's not a physical altar. If you look in the Greek, you're just going to see the word altar. And, well, it's not even really actually in the Greek. They do have different words. It's not actually the Greek in this case. It's the Latin. In the Latin, if you look in the Latin, you're going to just see the word altar in all three cases. Two of those are physical altars. You bring something to it, and you sacrifice something physically. And one of those was elata. Elata is the space within our consciousness, A-L-T-E. R, not A-R as in physical altar, but the space in our consciousness where things are altered, things are brought to the surface, things are essentially reintegrated back into the system and healed, so to speak. And he would say, look, your physical action cannot take the place of you doing the actual sacrifice of these disintegrative energies in your own consciousness. Understand that regardless of you doing something with a lamb and all the things that people do outside, it has nothing to do with an actual, the real altar at the center of our heart, the altar where we bring something into that space. It's never about the physical action. It's about our state of being. And that's the thing. He was very well aware that, look, if you're focused outside on a physical act of sacrifice or a physical prayer where you're out there preaching so that other people can see you, anything outward, that was considered to be a sin. That was considered to be a blasphemy to Jesus, but to Yeshua, but not necessarily to the culture at the time. They were and still are into physical sacrifice. And it's the funniest thing to me because it's like, this doesn't make a lot of, like, let's put it this way. Let's call me God. Let's make this anthropomorphized. And I am God, and I create these beautiful beings, these animals, and my beautiful children, etc. And somehow I'm going to be satisfied by you killing my child, or you killing and torturing my animal, and then burning its body or hanging it on a cross, whatever it may be, to offer it back to me? Are we really believing that God comes from these human states? Only a human would do something like that. It's our human perception of God as a finite being that somehow needs to be satisfied, that somehow needs a sacrifice, that somehow holds something against us that needs to be forgiven, that somehow is going to bring a child into this world and then ask us to kill it and send it back to him dead because somehow that absolves us from having to do our own work. It's absurd if we just take a step back and realize this. And that non-doing or the feminine aspects, we realize that it's not about the action and it's not even about inaction in the physical sense, but rather the state of our being as we are either acting or not acting. It's So just because you're not doing something physical, just as you spend, let's say, all day Saturday doing no physical work, does not mean that your consciousness is actually in Shabbat, is actually in the Sabbath, is actually in the stillness. It's not the lack of the physical action that makes it Shabbat. It's the state of your being. It's the state of your presence. The action is an external effect of the state of our being at all times. There's no exceptions to that. And the thing is, though, when we do reduce action and do have a time set aside of less physical action or no physical action and no a day of work, a day of rest, we have more access to the feminine aspects of our being, because we're not caught up in the physical things and the different actions that we're doing. We're able to be more in the silence and more in the quiet. That's something that we've really lost in the West. The Jews had it, and we all have access to it, those quiet times. We're all so busy doing, and then we think that not doing is somehow more conscious, but it's not the act of non-doing. It's actually the state of our being in that process, whether we're doing something or not. That's what's important.
Well, and that seems to tie into a definition you've given us in the past for faith. And in Matthew 6:30, it says, "O ye of little faith." And then in 6:34, in 9:22, Matthew, it says, "Thy faith has made thee whole." And in 15:28, it says, "O woman, great is thy faith." These are all from the King James Version. Is that the same word every time in those three references?
What were the three?
The first one is in 6:30, "Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not? 6:30.
What was the 6:30 of what book?
Matthew.
Matthew, okay. I've actually got an Aramaic Bible in front of me, so I'm going to look some of these up as you're saying them.
"Shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith?"
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for various references to the word faith to see if you could tell us, because I loved your definition of faith, that acting from the rooted center of your being, and if this word faith in these different references was the same, or if they're using all kinds of different words from the Aramaic and translating them all as the word faith.
Yeah, that's a good question, because what in a lot of cases there'll be like a basic root that's used. And I will say right here, I'm looking at it right in front of me in Matthew 6:30, it will say right there at the end, "O you of little faith," that word is ha'imanuta right in front of me. So, I mean, when I use the word faith, that's usually the general word that I use is ha'imanuta. Ha'imanuta is a word that you know, like I say, consciously acting from the rooted center of your being without going deep into linguistics. I've done that so much on past shows. So right here, actually, it's that word. If you give me some other examples, I can look them up, some other verses.
Okay, so how about Matthew 9:22?
9:22.
"Thy faith has made thee whole."
I have to cross-reference them, too, because sometimes the Aramaic doesn't line up with the King James in terms of the, number 20, let's look at 22, so that's probably Ha'imanu, where are we at, Ha'imanutki, which is basically the same thing. It's basically the same word in this, and it's interesting because that's actually the phrase before. What's interesting is that when you hear, you know, made you whole is actually incorrect. What that actually is saying is, what he's saying is chvi ha'imanutaki achayatak. And achayatak is an interesting word because it doesn't mean make you whole. What that actually means is to realize that you already are whole. In other words, when you come from the rooted center of your being, you realize that you were never sick, you were never diseased, there was nothing unwhole about you at any point. But when you come from the rooted center, you realize that there was nothing to heal in the first place. You already are whole, you already are complete. In other words, he's saying, look, you believed in an illusion, and now you're seeing truth. You're having the direct experience. And that only happens when you come from that rooted center. I've actually got a video on YouTube about this. And it may, I think it might be, I think it's one where it says, like, Aramaic Yeshua and Ernest Holmes, where I kind of talk about Ernest's teachings, and I also talk about, I think it's actually this phrase here that's there on YouTube that people can search, and you can actually see what it looks like on the screen, I think, if I remember correctly. But that's basically the same word here, too. So,
so in some of those references to healing, it's what you just said, that idea of acting from the rooted center of your being and realizing you were in a dream and the reality.
Yeah, I mean,
wholeness.
It's like what Michael would say of analog versus digital. You're no longer looking at the reflection or the digital copy of the direct analog experience. You're actually letting go of the reflection. You're letting go of the mask, of the ape, of the veil, the hypocrite, whatever. You're letting go of the false self, and you realize that sickness can only exist in the reflection. It can only exist in what appears to be the physical life, but the physical life is a projection of consciousness. And when you come back to the center of where it's projecting from, back to what would be called Zion in Judaism, you come back to Zion, the place of the projection at the center point of your being. Yeshua called it the Talanach, which was translated as closet. You come back to the center of your being, you realize that it's not about what you're seeing in your physical life, but that's just the end part of the process of what's projecting out from your being. And when you come back to the center, you realize that there is no such thing as a lack of wholeness unless that's what's obvious to me, unless that's something that my faith is in, the lack, or my, and then it's no longer faith, actually, and then it becomes belief, which would be the word ha'imanun. Now, ha'imanun, it's interesting because if you put manun at the end, what that means is it's a physical thing. It's like a physical belief. It's something like I have a belief in something. Like people say today to me all the time, you know, I've said this on the show, people say, what is your faith? And I'm like, well, you're going to have to define what faith means to you before I can answer the question. And I don't mean that in any way other than, look, understand that faith today means something. You have faith in the Bible, you have faith in Jesus. But in the ancient context, that was just belief. Faith was when we're living consciously from the rooted center of our being, and it's nothing, there's no duality in that. It's not you plus your faith or you plus that which you have faith in, but rather that when you're coming, living from your rooted center, you are faith. Your life is faith. Everything that you create is faith. Everything that you say is faith. Because it's coming from the center of the cosmos, essentially, rather than something that I believe in, which is our modern idea of what faith means.
Well, that's beautiful. And it's becoming more and more meaningful to me as I hear you say it, and I notice different things in my life when I'm not really working that hard, and yet things are falling into place. There was one more thing that I wanted to ask you about, and that is in Matthew 6:34, where it says, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Mm-hmm. Is there a way you can help us understand the use of the term evil and what might have been meant in that phrase?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I hear this phrase always makes me think of a friend of mine, Chad O'Shea, who just passed a couple of months ago. He was the minister of the Unity Center in Mills River, North Carolina, south of Asheville. And I remember he and I were, I had an event there at the Unity Center. We're going back 5 or 6 years, and he and I were standing in their little library, and we had a conversation about this actual phrase. And it's a very interesting phrase in Aramaic, because if you see it sort of in a King James, you can think, well, okay, you know, don't worry about tomorrow, because the stuff that's happening today, you know, is sufficient. Just focus on what's happening today. And while that's nice, it's almost cute to me compared to what it actually says in the Aramaic. One thing to realize here to begin with is that, first of all, there's no word in ancient Aramaic that means purely day. In other words, our word day today means basically day, like today is Friday. But yet there's a little more here in the English, like when we say back in the day, when you say it in that context, it doesn't mean on a specific day. It means a certain period of time. Another thing is we have the word time, which means whatever, the passing of time. We can also use the phrase, well, in that time, which, again, doesn't really mean a time necessarily. It means kind of a like a conglomeration of time or a span of time, which isn't quite what the literal word time means in English. In Aramaic, it's even more succinct because yauma would be the word that means, that would be translated as day. Sometimes it's yaumana, and I'll get back to yaumana. But yauma is an interesting word because it doesn't mean day such as this day today only, although that could be one of its meanings. What it means is a moment in time. And what yauma means is it could be a day, a week, a month, a year. It could be 10 years. It could be a moment in time. And when you start to look at this phrase, actually, you start to look a little bit deeper into it, you start to see that he's not necessarily just talking about sufficient unto today, Friday, are, and I'll get to that word evil too, you know, sufficient unto this day are the things that need to be done. While that's nice and it's kind of cute, it's actually much deeper than that, because what he's really saying in Aramaic is sufficient unto this very moment now. Now, right in this moment. And what's beautiful is that, such as when that word Yalma shows up in the Lord's Prayer in Matthew, when it says, which I believe is also Matthew, is it? I don't know if it's Matthew 6, but it's really close to here. When that shows up in the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, what that word is yaumana. Now, what's interesting is the word mana. Mana means what is it, purely in Aramaic in the literal sense on the top. But mana is, of course, we call it manna here in the West. That's also what fell from heaven when the Israelites connected into the true sustenance of life itself. That does not mean that pita bread was dropping out of the sky and knocking them into the skull. We need to grow up a little bit in what we're looking at here. What that means is they connected into the true sustenance, presence, realization, essence of life itself. Kind of like you're running 20 miles and you're on the 19th mile and you lose your oomph, and then all of a sudden you see your children on the side of the road and you remember why you were running in the first place and you get that second wind. That's mana. Mana is when it kicks in and you're no longer susceptible to the laws of time and space, to food, to the lack of food, to needing water. You transcend the physical laws. That's what mana means. And that can only happen right now in this present moment. Mana does not happen necessarily something in a physical sense, like it's something's dropping out of the sky and hitting us in the head. That's an infantile way of looking at that, and I know it's cute in movies, but we need to grow up with that. It's saying that when you're fully consciously present in this moment and you're aware of what is right now sufficient unto this very moment, are the things that need to be done, and also the evils. Now, what that word evil is in this case is bisha. Bisha was, of course, an archery term, but it's much more than that. It's an archery term in Aramaic and Hebrew and Greek and Latin. Bisha, evil, was when you would fire at a target. There's two aspects of the way bisha is defined. One is if you fired at the target and you completely missed the target, they would yell bisha, which meant you were completely off target, take another shot. There's other things that say that, as an example, as you fired at the target, if you missed the bullseye, they would yell chata, which is the word sin, which was, again, constructive criticism in archery. It meant you missed the mark, take another shot. And some of the research we have says that the bisha was not only when it was completely off target, but some people defined bisha early on as you had a sin. As an example, this was your sin. It hit off the bullseye, and where you hit was called your evil, which just meant, again, you didn't hit the bullseye, you were off target, take another shot, constructive criticism. Now, what that word evil really means in Aramaic is not simply an archery term. You can't stop there. You have to follow it to the point of completion. What it really meant was that it meant not now. It's a word, the word evil means unripe, as in a green banana, and it's stone green, or a black, greasy banana that there's flies, you know, buzzing all around it. I talk about this in Woodstock, you know, when I was up there, that what that means is not fertile, not fully present right now in this moment, and that's what the word bisha meant. So when he's saying sufficient unto this moment are the evils, what he's saying is anything that's keeping you out of the present moment, anything that's up for healing that needs to be processed and forgiven in this very moment, you're going to have to address them in the moment. You can't address them in the past. You don't address those in the future, but right now. And he's saying what? Tomorrow, the next moment will take care of itself. Never mind the next moment, because in truth, all that exists is right here and right now. And whatever is keeping you from the full presence in this moment is what needs to be forgiven. And remember, when we do the process of shabag, of forgiveness, and we remove the root that's causing our suffering, remove the root that's keeping us from being fully present in this very moment right now, we go into that process of teshbukta, which is, again, the state of being, where shabuk, this is the word glory, you remove whatever it was that was keeping you from being fully present in the moment, and you have the tesh or tish experience, which is where things glow and things gleam. When you're fully present in this moment and you lift out and you forgive whatever it is that's keeping you from the moment, then life begins to dance, life begins to shine, and that's when we experience glory, is when we're open in the moment outside of anything that we want other than the moment itself. And that's what that phrase really means in Aramaic. The theology of it's cute, but you can't stop at the theology. Theology is, actually, let me give you a little, I just happen to have this in front of me because I'm going to be quoting it tomorrow night. This is from Rumi. This is Ode 314 translated by Coleman Barks. He says, those who don't feel this love pulling them like a river, those who don't drink dawn like a cup of spring water, or take in sunset like supper, those who don't want to change, let them sleep. This love is beyond the study of theology, that old trickery and hypocrisy. I want you to improve your mind, or if you want to improve your mind that way, sleep on. I've given up on my brain. I've torn the cloth to shreds and thrown it away. If you're not completely naked, wrap your beautiful robe of words around you and sleep. And what he means by completely naked, if you're not willing to forgive whatever's up in this present moment, you're still holding on, you're still wearing your skin, you're still hiding, and you're still concealed. When you're willing to be fully present and forgive whatever's up in this moment, that's what it means to be naked. That's what it means to be alive now, right now.
Wow, and that's from where in Rumi?
That's Ode 314. It's in several of Coleman's books. It's a
beautiful,
powerful, powerful phrase, yeah.
Beautiful. And what was the reference you made, that the friend that this made you think of? Who is that person?
Chad O'Shea. Chad O'Shea was the minister of the Unity Center in south of Asheville, Mills River, North Carolina, for just decades. I think he actually started it way back when. He passed a couple of months ago. Chad was just this great crotchety guy that who I just loved, just rah, rah, you know, kind of grumpy, but so brilliant and so loving and so selfless in so many ways. Influential to so many people, especially in the Unity movement, but New Thought in general, you know, Unity, Science of Mind, Centers for Spiritual Living. He was just a real brilliant light, and he passed. Maybe it's been about 2 months now. And when he went, there was like a little bit of like a disturbance in the force. I mean, when someone shines that bright and is such an influence to so many people, you can feel the, you know, in the Star Wars sense, you can feel that Jedi force just kind of fluctuate a little bit when that one passes. And that's not his passing that causes the fluctuation. It's what that's resonating within us in our feeling of loss that causes that fluctuation. That's a very interesting distinction there.
Yeah, and as you say, this discussion you were just having about sufficient for the day or the evils thereof is shining new light on it for me, the idea of thinking in the present moment. Michael uses it. It's been a very useful tool for me to think in terms of setting goals just for the next waking hour and canceling goals after that period of time and before sleep. But this idea of using that in the moment and helping me focus even more on anything that takes me out of awareness in the moment. It makes me think if I learn to do that, among other things, I won't misplace my car keys as much.
Yeah, and it's all aspects of that. It is on the day level, it's on the week level, it's on the month level, it's on this hour, it's on this moment, it's on all levels. And that's the beauty of that word yama or yamana, is that yamana really is not necessarily day. Yamana that's in the Lord's Prayer really is moment. So when you hear give us this day, it's not quite right, because that mana aspect is, as an example, it's the gift that you get in the present moment. It's the present in the presence of this moment, is the mana. And that's really only there in the moment. That's not there on a day level. It's not there on an hour level or a week level. It's only available now, that true presence, when you're fully present now. But yama itself, it's on all aspects. You know, if you got a that's why, getting the stress you need, with Michael's work, there's so many freaking things I've learned, from what Michael has really crystallized, distilled, as I think is a better word, distilled things that we generally don't think about. Things like setting goals and not realizing that you set so many goals, and you get to a point where you're getting in a nervous breakdown, you've got so many goals that are set that either haven't been accomplished or haven't been canceled. It's amazing, just canceling goals, what that can do for you. And that's something that it's there in the Jesus teachings, but it's something that I didn't comprehend until I heard it through Michael's work. I heard it right in the beginning of my study of the Jesus teachings, at least in the Aramaic sense. And a lot of people that are looking at Yeshua's teachings, including in Aramaic, bless their hearts, still don't really know what they're looking at, because they're stopping at the theology, they're stopping at the definition, and they're not getting all the way to the root meaning of what it actually means, what the words actually mean, rather than just their definition.
Yeah, I have to agree with you that it's absolutely been transformative for me to apply some of the tools Michael has come up with. And just so people know, that almost all of those tools are available for free on Michael's website at www.whyagain.org. And would you consider coming back to Woodstock in November, Dale, if we can find a date?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, speaking of that, I've been talking with them here in Indiana about coming back here sometime in the fall, and we could probably tie it all together, one, like a weekend here, a weekend there. That would be perfect, actually. Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that my November at this point, I've been so focused on writing that my schedule has kind of, going out 3 or 4 months out, kind of got quiet because I've been so focused on writing, and I think that would be perfect. Yeah, it would be beautiful.
Well, Reverend Tom asked me to mention that to you, and this might be a good time for you to just, if there's anything you want to promote or let us know about before we run out and have to squeeze it in at the end.
Simply that tomorrow night I'll be at the State Theater, downtown South Bend, Indiana, just south of Lake Michigan, right near Notre Dame and Holy Cross, all the great universities around here. I'll be speaking from 7 to 9 p.m., and I'm going to do my best to have a space for questions. Next weekend, I've got my Mary Magdalene retreat, the Divine Feminine retreat in Asheville. The week after that, I'm in at the Cleveland Airport Marriott on Saturday the something. It's not me right now, but it's on my calendar. I'm in at the Cleveland Airport Marriott. That's been organized by a lot of New Thought ministers. And then I'm in at Unity in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and then back the next day back to the Cleveland area to Strongsville, Ohio. And then the week after that, I'm at Unity North in Marietta, Georgia, north of Atlanta, for a couple of days. It's been so – I felt so honored by Ira Powers, actually, a friend of mine from New Jersey. He lives in Mantua, New Jersey, and he came – to hear me in New Jersey last week, and he gave me a great compliment because he said his eyes were just dancing, he was lit up, and he was like, every time I hear you, it's like you've grown so exponentially, you've grown so much. He said it's inspiring, and I'm like, I think the reason that you feel inspired is because, I'm writing the inspiration, and he's not necessarily just inspired by me, but rather his reflection in observing. I seek to be open in the moment. I'm constantly looking to blow my biases apart. I'm constantly looking to obliterate whatever preconceived notions I may think in the Jesus teachings or against some particular culture because I didn't think they got it or something. I'm constantly looking to forgive that, to be completely clear and completely clean and completely open in the moment. And what that means is that I'm surfing the leading edge of the cosmos. It's like my surfboard is right at the tip of that expansion as spirit is constantly growing and growing and growing. And I don't necessarily know where I'm going in the process. I'm just fully in the moment, and I'm just letting myself be led through and spoken through. And it's scary in the beginning, honestly. It brought a lot of fear up for me, and I threw the fear off, and I just kept going. And I felt it, in the words of Susan Jeffers, I felt the fear, and I did it anyway. What a great thing, you know, to actually allow yourself to feel it and continue to do it, and then continue to forgive that fear out of the system. This is the way we're meant to live, and I don't live it perfectly at all times, but I'm definitely learning more day by day and moment by moment with it. So,
well, and as you say, the first three Beatitudes, I really like your short summary. I love the poetic nature of the way Yeyim has written those out, and yet even more succinct is your quick summary. You want to give us your quick English translation of the three steps in the first three Beatitudes?
Well, I can do it really simply, which is breathe, step into what you're feeling, and let it move through the system. Let it flow, let it breathe, let it pass. Breathe, feel it, let it pass. To put simply, and I could go deeper into it, but get the breath.
Yeah,
and that's not just breath, actually. That word rucha is breath. It's those eternal forces, you know, the polarities and all of those different feelings we have of something in movement. But the breath is the key to that one, stepping into what you're feeling, allowing yourself to feel it by breathing, and allowing it to move through the system by allowing yourself to feel it through breathing. So,
yeah, and that's I just kept thinking of that as you were talking about sufficient for the day or in this very moment. Remove everything that keeps me from being aware in the moment. And I kept thinking about the first three Beatitudes because a lot of things resonate in me, tightness, tension, fear, resistance, irritation. And if I can just get myself to recognize it and breathe, feel it, and let it flow through me, then I can come back to be much more aware of the moment.
Yes.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us. It is an honor, and especially on this day, your birthday, thank you to your family for sharing you with us. And thanks for being here, and I'm certain that Michael looks forward to having you back on the show next Friday. And have a wonderful time over this weekend, blessing people there in the Indiana, South Bend, Mishawaka area. And I hope you feel the gratitude.
I do. Thank you. Thank you for the space.
It's a privilege to be with you. Thank you, Michelle, for monitoring the chat room. And thank you to all who are on hold and listening. And I know I, for one, will be listening to this show on the archives. This is a Friday, so please come back again on Monday. We're here 5 days a week from noon to 1. Hopefully Michael and Jeannie will be back. Michael has someone scheduled to be on the show next Monday who should be a joy to have. She's a woman who does conscious parenting, and she does a blog about it. And we look forward to having you there with us, and have the best year yet of your eternal life.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com. mindshiftersradio.com.
Continuously, 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 continuously.